Good morning, everyone. I am back home again. And the really good news is I'm back home for 6 weeks. I am actually going nowhere until I think the second week of December. And I'm going to talk later on about what that is and where I'm going. But I'm pretty adamant that I'm certainly not going to go overseas anywhere for the next 6 weeks. I actually had a call with someone only about half an hour ago, and they're like, oh, would you like to come to this thing? It's like, no, 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 I'm staying home. And part of the joy of my, or the joy that I'm expressing at the moment about being home is it's 33 degrees Celsius here today. The sun is shining. The pool is warmed up. It's just like the best freaking time of the year, other than all the other times, which are also really, really good. But I think it's when you're seeing the change and you see the summer coming. So, I'm really looking forward to actually churning out a bunch of stuff too. I've got a heap of Have I Been Pwned things I want to do, a heap of blog things I want to do. So hopefully this is like day one of a very productive 6 weeks. Now, be that as it may, I did get home last night from my last bit of travel for a while. In fact, last week, I forget all the things I've done. Last week, obviously, I was in Texas, and I flew with my wife from Dallas to Sydney. Incidentally, that holiday was obviously I did conferences and things as well, but that trip, shall we say, was, I think, the most enjoyable trip to the US that I have ever had in terms of just really sort of appreciating the culture in ways I hadn't before. And I think I said last week, maybe it's a Texas thing. I don't know. But everyone was super friendly. I really enjoyed that. And it sort of has reset my perceptions on the US a little too, in very positive ways. So anyway, we flew from Dallas straight to Sydney, 17-hour flight. Thank you very much. So that was fun. And then went through Sydney, hung around there for a few hours, got on a plane, flew to the Gold Coast, and I had less than 24 hours at home, and then it was like back to Sydney again. So let me talk a little bit about the event that I did there on Tuesday, which was different to what I have done before. Now, let me explain how this worked. So I did a panel discussion for a conference called Sibos, and the Sibos conference is owned by Swift. Swift are the people that do all the international banking transfer stuff. So, when you pay for example, if I get paid for something from the US, it's like, hey, here's my Swift account or my Swift number, and then they do the international routing. And I've probably done the explanation of that a big injustice, but big bank stuff internationally, I think people can agree with. Now, they asked me to do a panel, and I've done a lot of panels before, and panels all over the world and different conferences for dev stuff and security stuff and all this sort of stuff. So I thought, I have some panels, no dramas. I know what I'm doing here. And it was kind of funny in the lead up because they wanted to have a lot of meetings about what was going on in the panel. And I'm sort of going, it's a panel. You turn up, you ask me questions, I answer them. We play off each other a bit, like what's to plan. Anyway, the penny kind of dropped when I got to the conference. I was like, I've not been to a conference before with armed guards, sniffer dogs, and x-ray machines in order to get into the event. Nor have I turned up at one in a suit as well, which is a very, very rare thing for me. This is dress. I put a shirt on for this, right? So for this podcast, this video thing. So that was very unusual. And, there's like a little bit of me, which like is obviously not a particularly formal sort of guy. But there's also the other side of it, me, which is like, it's always interesting to do different things. I don't want to say outside my comfort zone because I think I was very comfortable with it, but different to the norm. So anyway, I was on a panel with a couple of other folks as well, including, I think her correct title is the head of cybersecurity of Telstra, which is our big telco, and a Russian bloke in banking. And I'm sorry I've done Dmitry a big disservice by probably not understanding his role better, but it was someone that I just met on the day. Both lovely people with very interesting insights. Anyway, so we did this panel, and the panel was effectively, I'm going to read you the title here, and I know some people lose their freaking minds this title. Is a cyber 9/11 inevitable? Now, you can imagine me as I'm preparing for this going, this seems to be very sort of formally prepared, and then it's like both cyber and 9/11, which are obviously kind of buzzwordies. But the thing is that this was made for a demographic, which was bankers, I met some people the night before at the speaker party that were like from the Federal Reserve Bank in the US, like these sorts of people. And the reason for all the security, I think, was that they're just very high value targets. It still seemed rather excessive to me, but I don't know what I'm talking about when it comes to how to run a banking conference. So anyway, it was sort of targeted at that audience that wanted to be spoken to at that level. And I guess that cyber 9/11 kind of makes sense to them, buzzwords aside. But the interesting sort of things that came out of it, and there is actually a video I just found, so I'm going to link to the video at the in the references for this video. And you can kind of go and have a look at it if you want. But it was interesting where the discussion was largely around, could there be some sort of catastrophic black swan event? So a black swan event being something that we haven't sort of seen coming, but then has some fundamental impact on our lives, which is really what 9/11 was. And I think what they're trying to say here is, could this now happen in a digital world? So could it be your critical infrastructure suddenly blown up and changing the shape of the nation? And obviously everyone's sort of speculating here. But the conclusion that we all drew in terms of, is that more or less likely in the next 10 years, which was sort of the very thing that was asked at the end, was all of us kind of went, look, there is so much connected stuff now, and there's so much interdependency, and there's so many critical things running on this, and there are so many people trying to take advantage of it. It's hard to imagine that within the next decade, there won't be some sort of massive catastrophic event that does kind of reset our compass around how we think of online security. Who knows? Let's talk again in 10 years and we'll see if the three panelists were right about that or not. One of the other things that came out of this, which was very interesting, and I haven't watched the whole thing back, and I might find it was just more my bias than the other people, but one thing that we seem to keep coming back around to was vulnerabilities in humans. There were sort of discussions going on about how are many of these attacks taking place, what's going wrong. Very often we're seeing compromises of people. So for example, in the financial industry, we know that there's this whale phishing problem, or the CEO scam, the issue where someone manages to impersonate the CEO, calls up someone and says, you know, that $20 million we're meant to transfer, we're actually got to send it over there instead of over here. And this is human exploitation. We try and fix this with technical controls. We sometimes get it right. Very often the folks doing the social engineering get it right. So anyway, I'll link to that. It is not the normal sort of thing that I do, but I did think it was an interesting experience anyway. So I did that on Tuesday. Wednesday and Thursday, I did a private workshop in Sydney, which went really well. Wrapped up that, came home. That is it for the events. Now, that did not give me much time, any time, to actually blog anything. But there were several other things that popped up during the week, which I thought were particularly interesting and noteworthy and worthy of discussion here. One of these things has made me very happy, and it is, I'm just trying to read the headline here, Have I Been Pwned is in the Gizmodo's list of 100 websites that shape the internet as we know it. Now, if I'm honest, I'm always a little bit reticent to sort of get too much into these top, you know, X lists of N things or whatever it may be, because frankly, some of them are just marketing exercises for companies. But this was Gizmodo, which is relatively reputable, and it was a list that includes, if I go back to like the biggest things, I think the biggest one was Wikipedia. And incidentally, holy shit, there are a lot of ads here. Why isn't my pie hole blocking this? Maybe. Occasionally, I do roll DNS on my host PC directly to 1.1.1.1, which is Cloudflare, and it doesn't route through pie hole. This will be an interesting exercise later if I turn the pie hole back on. And I think the penny is just dropping about how much stuff Piehole actually blocks. Oh, well, I remember it. For those of you watching, I got a Piehole cup. Cool. Anyway, it's tangential. So number one was Wikipedia. And this is a list that, okay, number one, Wikipedia, number two, Google, number three, YouTube. Like, this is just massive, massive stuff. And Have I Been Pwned slipped in at like number 83 or something. Where is it? Yeah, number 83. After a series of major data breaches, security expert Troy Hunt decided to make a website where potential victims could check and see if their data had been compromised. Now you just type in your email address, click Have I Been Pwned, and see the hackers got you. Fun fact, Gizmodo's original parent company, Gawker, was one of the original five hacks indexed. It was Gawker, it was LinkedIn, no, not LinkedIn, sorry, Gawker, Adobe, Stratfor, I can't remember the other two. But anyway, this is just super, super cool. And it's something that a lot of people saw. So look, I mean, honestly, I get Google alerts. So every single day I see when have I been pwned or my name gets mentioned somewhere. And every single day it's in the news somewhere or other. But it's very unusual for many people from different walks of life to pop up and say, hey, we saw your thing in our community or our usual reading list or whatever it may be. And loads of people popped up and found this, which was really cool. So I was showing my wife, actually, and I said, look, this is awesome. And she's looking down the list of sort of notable sites. And what's the subtle way of putting this? Number 97 was Goatsy. Now, don't Google this. Don't Google images in particular if you don't already know what it is. And to put it in perhaps the most socially acceptable fashion possible, it is a very confronting image designed to cause offense that usually people put in unexpected places or if they've possibly compromised a website. I just want to make impact. It is very graphic and very visual. But it is definitely part of the internet culture, and it's always going to be one of these things that did in some way shape the internet. So I'm glad that I'm in company such as things like Netflix as well. But anyway, that kind of made me happy to see that there. So that was that. Now, this was not intended to go from like one salacious topic to another, but I shared a tweet the other day, and I got a reaction to it. Really only from one person, but it is a theme that I've seen before. And in fact, what I'm going to do, I'm going to talk about the product that I tweeted about. And if you've got kids in the car, this might be the time, if you listen to the podcast, where you want to, you know, close their ears or something. I will try and be as mature as I can when I explain this. There is a Kickstarter project called MyHixel. The byline of this is the revolutionary method for men's sexual well-being, the ultimate medically proven method for male climax control. Now, if I'm honest, I haven't really read all of the detail. I have read far enough to know that you connect it to your phone and that you have an account somewhere and that you log in and that one would assume some form of usage, or at least the fact that you own the device, is then captured on the internet. Now, I suspect that 99%-something of people would have a very similar reaction to me. And my reaction, this was the tweet, was, pro tip, you have rocks in your head if you connect anything to the internet related to male climax control. Now, let me explain why I said this, just in case it's not immediately obvious. I probably have a slightly different perspective because I have seen a lot of data breaches, but the number of times I have seen personal data in context that people never expected to see go public, I just remember I got a data breach to talk about that demonstrates this. Remind me after I do this. The number of times I've seen data of very personal natures which people never expected to see public, the number of times I have seen devices with serious vulnerabilities that have led to this. CloudPets, perfect example. Kids' voices exposed over the internet because of vulnerabilities in CloudPets. VTech, same sort of thing. Kids' photos, names, addresses. Thinking about even things like Nissan, the fact that Nissan Leaf had vulnerabilities in the app that allowed you to control the car. Let's be clear, the air conditioning in the car, climate control, pullback trip history, pullback battery status. Fortunately, not driving features. Google all these things. They're all out there. Even more recently, put it in the adult industry realm, WeVibe, which is a company that makes adult toys, which you connect. They got fined catastrophically. That was really bad. It was like tens of millions of dollars, I think. In total, because of the fact they were collecting usage data, mapping it to personally identifiable attributes, and it seemed to be a problem with consent or awareness of people as to what they're doing. When you capture data of this nature as an individual, you take on a heightened risk. Like this is not a negotiation, right? Like this is what happens. If you take on this particular class of data, you connect it to the internet, you capture this information, you now have something in a digital format that you didn't have before. When it's in a digital format, the likelihood of it being compromised suddenly goes through the roof. If, for argument's sake, And again, I said, maybe no kids in the car. If you want to go out and get an adult sex toy and go to town on it with batteries in your own bedroom, not connected to anything else, that is a very, very different risk profile. Unless someone is present there in your room, they're really not going to be aware that you have one and that you're using it in this fashion. Start sending all that data up to the internet, and suddenly the risk changes fundamentally. To be clear as well, I could not care less what people do with adult sex toys in their bedroom. This has got absolutely nothing to do with me. I have no ethical angst against it or anything like that. There is no moral judgment. Go nuts, have fun, who cares? I'm simply saying that this creates a heightened risk, and you need to be aware of that risk and decide whether you want to take it on. You're in control of that risk. Now, to the tweet that disagreed with this, and how anyone disagrees with it is a little bit beyond me, if I'm honest. Someone said it was moral panic. I don't care. You can go and do it if you want. I'm going to say exactly the same thing about the teddy bears. It's not moral panic. I don't have a moral objection to using a cloud pet. I have a risk objection to using a cloud pet. Security nihilism. I just don't even know how you get to that. It's like, do a risk assessment. If I digitize the data, I've got this risk. If I don't digitize, and people just freaking lose their minds over it. It's the same sort of thing where I wrote something some time ago, and I knew people would get upset about this, but that alone is not a good reason not to write it. I wrote something about effectively, once you digitize data, you take on heightened risks. So if you want to get involved in sexting and things like this, first of all, it's entirely your decision. But if you do it, just be conscious of the risk it creates. And if you don't do it, you don't have the risk. And just explaining it just seems fundamentally ridiculous to even need to say it. And of course, some people, when asked, victim blaming. People should be able to take photos of their equipment. And yes, they should be able to take photos of it. And they can. And if they do, their risk goes up. Like, what's hard to understand about that? So, I found that very odd. And look, you know what? Here's almost like the measure that I apply to it. So I've got a 6-year-old daughter and a 9-year-old son. So they are going to be approaching the ages where they find new things on the internet and they have camera phones, all this sort of stuff. And I always think, what would I tell them about risk? Now, maybe this person who made the comment doesn't have kids or hasn't thought about it or just has a different perspective on life. But I can't imagine anyone going, yeah, sure, mate, like go and take photos of your junk and text them to each other. You have the right to do that. And leave the conversation. Like, you wouldn't leave the conversation of that. You'd go, mate, you really, really don't want to do that. Like, if you do that, have you thought through what might happen? That's the discussion I'd be having with my kids. And I would argue that 99%-something of people would be having exactly the same discussion. Anyway, so let's move on past that because, frankly, I think it's a bit of a pointless thing to even have to need to discuss. actually, I was going to go on to another pointless thing to need to discuss, which is EV. But let me first talk about that breach I mentioned. And I think I touched on the breach when I was in Texas last week, but it hadn't yet gone public. And this, oh man, it's another salacious one. This was not the intention. This is not meant to be like the adult version of Troy's weekly update. But there is a site, let's see if it's still up or not, called wifelovers.com. Now, I've just noticed the site is up, but it has a notice to users. So you can safely, in your place of work, go to wifelovers.com if they've not blocked the domain, because as of a week ago, it was not a site that you really would have wanted to go to at work. The wifelovers.com site, as best I could tell, was designed for guys to post naked photos of their wives. Certainly, that's what the title kind of implies, and that is what the bulletin board system they're running or the forum they're running on was rather full of. Now, again, not wanting to raise moral panic, this is something that you really want to think about whether it is a good idea or not. If you are a guy or possibly a wife thinking about using one of these services, there is without doubt a very serious question to be asked here around the consensual nature of it. I would find it hard to imagine, although I accept that maybe this is not the case, but I find it hard to imagine that most of the women whose photos were posted to this site went along with it and knew what was going to happen. It's like, yeah, fine, take a photo of me, like completely naked, spread out in the bed, and put it on this website so that guys can go and comment on their ratings of me and some of the things they would perhaps do were they in that room. And this is basically what it was. You can find this on archive.org if you want to go back and see exactly what it was. So anyway, there's Wife Lovers. There are about seven other sites as well that all fronted this same underlying database. And they had some pretty serious SQL injection vulnerabilities. Someone sucked all the data out, sent it to me, 1.2 something million people on this site. I tried to get in touch with them. I did contact them via the one email address I could find published. Couldn't get in touch with them at all. I put a tweet out, said, hey, does anyone have a contact at Wife Lovers? You can imagine how people reacted to that. I did then have a journo, Dan Gooden at Ars Technica, reach out and say, look, let's make sure that these people know what's going on. And he did what good journos do, which is that he did actually get a response from them. And it was their data and it was legit. And now it is in Have I Been Pwned as a sensitive data breach. So you cannot search for someone else publicly. And the site has subsequently been shut down. It's for the most part like just business as usual data breach 101 sort of stuff. That the bit that I'm hesitating about is that there's the thing about the consensual nature. I suspect that there are a lot of women on that site that did not expect to be on there. And that, of course, raises some pretty serious legal issues as well around sextortion and the like. And the other thing that I found very interesting about this was effectively the decloaking of individuals. So when you go to the site, or when you went to the site, you could see someone that they'd post a photo, their username would be there. You could hover over their username and it would give you an email address. And every one of those email addresses was clear, or certainly everyone I saw, was clearly intended not to be a personally identifiable one. And it was a fabricated address made for, I assume, private communication with other people without revealing an identity. They were not the email addresses in the data breach. The email addresses in the data breach were obviously people's private addresses, the ones they didn't want to share publicly. So think about what you got now. You've got a website with publicly facing information, so you know, username and the email address they want to share publicly, and then the photos they're posting. But when you have the data breach, you also have the private email addresses of the people involved and the IP addresses, which of course gives some confirmation about location if you can track them down by other means. So for the sake of exercise, this is what I did with Dan in order to try and illustrate what is the potential impact of this. So I went and took one of the recent posts, took the username from it, found the person in the data breach, found their email address. It took about 5 minutes to find the sporting club this guy was involved in because his email address was in there in one location, to then go through and also find other things that he'd posted on other sites related to the same sport. I'm trying not to give too much away here due to, you know, obviously respecting the guy's privacy. And I know some of you have an issue with that, but look, assume privacy. This is my position on this. Then found his Instagram account. Instagram account had lots of imagery of the same sort of sport that he was involved in. And also the IP address from the Wife Lovers breach aligning with the geolocation of which the guy was obviously present in. So you can sort of see how all the dots join up. And it is hard not to imagine that there would be really severe, possibly life-changing ramifications for the bloke had he been outed like this. And again, sort of putting your moral compass about whether people should be doing this or not aside, and then also even putting the consensual nature of it aside, which is, again, not just moral, this is potentially legal. An incident like this just could be absolutely catastrophic. I mean, Ashley Madison, people killed themselves after it, and that's kind of the level of catastrophe that it could potentially be for some people. And this is why, I mean, trying to, again, be very serious about it, when we talk about things like devices that connect or collect personal data and put them on the internet, this is why I'm just so ultra, ultra cautious about saying to people, look, this stuff gets leaked all the time and it can have a really, really serious impact on your life. You know, honestly, just do not share information that you don't need to. And really, this is a very basic fundamental InfoSec tenet, which is you cannot lose what you do not have. So think about how many things that you do actually want to have in that regard. All right, moving on. Let's get past all this sort of sensational stuff. EV certificates. Now, this keeps coming up over and over again. And if I'm honest, it comes up less so now because I think the penny's probably dropped for most people. But very occasionally, someone pops up and espouses the virtue of EV. Now, this inevitably always reaches the same conclusion in terms of understanding the person's motives, which I'll come back to in a moment. But someone, and I won't actually link to the person because I don't want to sort of throw the guy under the bus. Maybe he was drunk or stoned or over a period of days. I don't know. Or maybe with all respect to him, he just has a different view. So someone popped up and was very, very confident that extended validations were a very good thing. Extended validation certificates and identity is important and all these other things are important and that somehow it actually works when it clearly doesn't. I put out a bit of a tweet storm and I just want to sort of recap on what some of these tweets were and then I'll talk about that inevitable conclusion I mentioned before. It's really funny to sort of look at some of the arguments in favor of EV and how irrational they tend to be, increasingly irrational as time goes by. And as, for example, more browsers kill visual indicators, which is really the only value proposition of EV. So I've sort of said here in this series of tweets, EV is dying a slow death. The company name indicator is now gone from Safari on iOS and macOS. So it went from iOS 12 and it went from Mojave both last month. It's not there on Chrome or Edge on mobile and is actively being tested for removal from Chrome on the desktop. And in fact, I think this is what upset the person in the first place. They saw it removed and then down in the dev tools in the console, it says, hey, Chrome is testing removing this. You're part of the experiment. Whether you think it's useful or not, there's no denying it's dying. And honestly, look, this is an absolute cornerstone of the position I take on this, which is I appreciate some people have different views on these things and they may think there's value to it. But whether you think it's valuable or not, like read the writing on the wall, right? Like it is being killed out of every browser. So if you can't see that coming, you're missing something really obvious. And if you think that you understand something that the likes of Google and Apple just simply don't understand, you're probably missing something else as well. There's a very good reason these tech companies are removing it. And in case you haven't been following along, the reason why is because nobody knows what it is. You know, there's like this tiny, tiny percentage of people, and for everyone else, it's just confusing noise in the address bar. Now, the next tweet here, despite assertions to the contrary, HTTP TLS SSL is about security. So there's this really weird argument that it's not about security. And Scott actually made the point. He said, what do you think the S in HTTPS and SSL and TLS stands for? Turns out it's security. So that was kind of a weird thing. And in fact, I linked here to the Wikipedia definition. The Wikipedia definition is websites can use TLS to secure all communications between their server and web browsers. And I suspect, again, trying to see both sides of it, some people get upset because of Google Chrome saying secure near the address bar. Now, of course, Google Chrome no longer says that, and it hasn't done for some time now. And that was something which could be implied to mean different things. But they don't do that anymore. And if you clicked on it, they did actually say quite clearly the connection is not secure, and secure is the right word to use. So we'll move on past that. Another one here that keeps coming up is the validity period of certificates and people wanting long validity periods so that they don't have to manually do things. And I made a point here, said manual renewal is another problem. We've seen so many cases of certs not being renewed even by the big guys, even by the very CA so actively selling EV. And I've linked through to Komodo certificate transparency site, crt.sh, where they recently forgot to renew their certificate. And this is a CA, you know, after Let's Encrypt now, the biggest CA. And they forgot to renew their certificate. Now that alone is interesting because it sort of demonstrates the need to automate renewal. And it's kind of like anyone who's been working in software for any amount of time knows that if something is important and you have to keep doing it over and over, you automate it. So this is the joy of things like Let's Encrypt or using Cloudflare who reissues certificates for you. So that was part of the amusing thing with the Komodo situation. Obviously, they didn't have automation. They didn't have automation because renewal of EV certificates is still manual. And then they didn't just go and get a DV certificate, which they could have gotten immediately. They had to jump through the hoops of EV, even obviously for their own processes, because according to someone, that's their policy. So it's like, all right, your policy is to leave the site broken for everyone, rather than put a DV certificate there, which no one knows the difference of between that and an EV anyway. But incidentally, every time I say no one knows the difference, obviously there are some people that do. I'm rounding up. And when I say I'm rounding up, every time I go to a workshop or a conference or even communications on Twitter, the percentage of people that actually know what EV is ridiculously low. It is very low single digits. And I literally ask, I will go to an event. There'll be hundreds of people in the room. Put your hand up if you know what an EV certificate is. And there's like a dozen people. And that'd be it. And they're the smart technical people. You know, they're not like the masses, so they're overrepresented in terms of the greater society. We've all heard the mantra before, something, if you need to do something often and it's important, automate it. We've covered that. There's an interesting argument as well. In fact, Scott Helm answers this question very, very well, or addresses this very, very well. People say, I would like to see EV so that I know the site is safe to do business with. Now, there's a really interesting image in this tweet thread, which is of the excluded purposes for EV certificates. And one of the excluded purposes for EV certificates is that it is safe to do business with the subject name in the EV certificate. Like, literally the requirements for EV specifically say, do not look to EV to think it is safe. And then you get proponents of EV going, I'm going to look for EV, so now it's safe. It's like, you don't actually realize that's literally the opposite of what it's meant to do, right? The premise that security should be expensive. This was a really interesting argument that came up. So the argument was, people are expecting security to be free, and that is bad. Now, the penny for me dropped later on when I realized what the motives were. I didn't realize at the time. I sort of took it at face value. But the argument here was that when people get a free certificate, they expect security to be free, and then they get upset when it's not free. And I just cannot possibly reconcile how this makes any sense at all. By having free certificates with the likes of Let's Encrypt, and again Cloudflare, which incidentally still issues Komodo certificates, but they bundle it all up and they do it for free. The value proposition of that has meant that we're now at more than 3/4 of all web traffic being encrypted, more than half of the world's top million websites forcing HTTPS. We've had huge adoption rates, more traffic than ever being secured and looked after, which is a good thing. And one of the massive drivers for that is having certificates being free. That doesn't mean that penetration tests should now be free. And it doesn't mean that secure code training should now be free. I'm going to have bigger problems if that's what it means. Like, it doesn't mean any of that. And my tweet here is, the premise that security should be expensive and that free alternatives encourage negative behaviors is 100% wrong. We're only reaching such great HTTPS adoption rates now because it is free. And all these guys agree. And I link through to the Let's Encrypt sponsors, which is just like a who's who of tech companies. I'll go on. These discussions tend to highlight thinking from a bygone era. We view HTTPS differently today than we did just a couple of years ago. Same as we view, say, mandated password rotation, which is something even the NCSC discourages. And I'll drop that in there because one of the arguments in this really bizarre tweet thread that went on for days was that EV certificates are important, just like rotating passwords are important. And that's the bygone thinking era. So we've seen not just the NCSC, but NIST as well, come out and say, stop rotating passwords because you're causing negative behaviors. And the negative behaviors we speak about are people just increment the number at the end of their password. Or they have trouble remembering it, so they put it on a post-it note. Or they fall down to other anti-patterns in terms of security in order to deal with the shortcomings that we as humans have. So that's a little bit tangential, but it was just weird. What I keep hearing is how people want EV to work. It should mean this, or it should do that. And I don't disagree that identity verification remains a challenge, but that's not what EV does today. No amount of merely wishing it was different will make it so. And this to me, and this sort of rounds out this tweet storm, this to me sort of sums it up. And this is the arguments I continually hear from people, which is that identity verification is important. There should be a way of identifying who owns the website. There should be a way of making people feel safe. And I don't disagree with that. But let's not kid ourselves into thinking it's EV, because it is not that, and that's why it's dying. Now, the inevitable conclusion I touched on a few times is that every single time I have seen someone aggressively in favor of EV, it's because they sell EV certificates. And then this inevitably turned out to be the case. So maybe what I should do in the future is just lead with, okay, let's all put our cards on the table. Let's just be clear, full disclosure, who has what sort of interests? Now, for Scott and myself, we have no interest in certificates. We don't sell certificates. We don't make money off free certificates. I've donated some money to Let's Encrypt. Maybe that's disclosure. Who knows? But maybe I'll lead with that in future. Could be easier. All right, something else. And this was just really played out in the last 24 hours. The Apollo data breach. So Apollo is that data aggregator in the US that left a whole bunch of data exposed. I think it was about 120 million something unique email addresses, including mine, got left exposed. Security researcher found it, sent me the data. It's in Have I Been Pwned? And the challenge, I guess, with the Apollo situation is that, let's say in my case, I gave my data to New Relic. New Relic does application performance monitoring, things like this. They do a good job of that. I've met a bunch of people there. I've been to their offices in San Fran. Very nice people. I like the New Relic guys. And at some point in time, they have then provided my data to Apollo. Apollo's lost the data. Now, I've started dropping stuff into a blog post because I think the shape of this post or the tone of this post will emerge over the coming days. But the post is effectively going to be, what did I tentatively title it? Lessons from an American Data Aggregator Breach in a GDPR Era. And let me just read some of the tweets I've seen, and then you guys can kind of make up your mind. So someone here, a bunch of people made subject access requests to Apollo. So within the scope of GDPR, you can make a SAR, subject access request, which effectively says, I as a data subject would like to see my data. Which, incidentally, GDPR aside, sounds like a very reasonable thing to do. So let me show you some of the responses, because people have made subject access requests to Apollo and had responses back from them. This is in chronological order too. Someone says, I had a response to my GDPR request. They've screen capped the discussion with Trevor at Apollo, and Trevor features a lot. I think Trevor has had an absolute shit day out of responding to these, if I'm honest. He says, thank you for your inquiry. As a data processor, we obtained and processed your data at the written instruction of our customer. Accordingly, we cannot acknowledge your request. Now, this is a bit of a theme, and this is where I think it gets very interesting and where I'm trying to find the right narrative for the post. A bunch of people got very upset because they said, I thought GDPR was meant to help me get access to my data. And I fully understand that sentiment. My understanding also is that a data processor doesn't necessarily have to respond to a subject access request. They are processing on behalf of a customer, and indeed there could be privacy violations if they do that because their accountability is to another customer, such as New Relic. Now again, this is my back of the napkin understanding from chatting to people online. If there's one thing I know about GDPR, it's that no matter what you say, someone else will get upset and say you're wrong. So I'm just relaying what I see here. Someone else shared a response, also from Trevor. Thank you for your inquiry. As a data processor, we obtain and process your data at the written instruction of our customer. Accordingly, we cannot acknowledge the request. I have a feeling Trevor's been doing a lot of copying and pasting because that is exactly the same message. Not on this one though. Here's another one. So this person, that their tweet says, odd that I got this response, a bit obnoxious, but did what I asked. So this time Apollo has said, thank you for your inquiry. We have voluntarily deleted your data, which consists of first name, last name, email address, title, and company from our database, which is interesting. Now, I wonder if this is maybe, and I'm thinking out loud here, I've honestly not given this any thought until now. I wonder if perhaps Peter, the guy who did the last tweet, if his data was obtained by Apollo in a different fashion to which the other people were. We'll go on. So another one here. Someone says, Apollo responded to me today that they had deleted all my info. They ignored the rest of my request for a copy of my data and who it was shared with. Brian Honan. I know Brian. Brian is a journo over in the UK. He says, same here. Have responded to them looking for those details, saying we got your data without your permission, but trust us, it is now deleted. Doesn't wash. It's hard to argue with Brian on that one. Trevor again in another quote here. Thank you for your inquiry. We have voluntarily deleted your data, which consists of blah, 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 blah. So this was the same message as the other one. I think Trevor's got like two different things he's copying and pasting from. But there's another bit in this which I found particularly interesting. He says, We collect information from publicly available resources and also are provided data from customers in connection with services that we provide to those customers. Let me read this first bit of it again. We collect information from publicly available resources. Now, I can only speculate on what they mean by that, but one of the things that I learned from the Exactus data breach, same sort of thing, massive data aggregator pulling data together from all sorts of different places, was that multiple people got in touch with me and said the email address that I had in Exactus was a LinkedIn email address, only ever used on LinkedIn. Multiple people saying the same thing. And when you think about it, we want to be a bit careful here because I'm not necessarily saying Apollo does this, but if you were to think about it, it would be very valuable for an organization that was charged with collecting large amounts of data to enrich personal details and everything. It would be very valuable for them to go to data breaches and pull personal information from there because it is a very rich source of it. Geez, think about something like the Wife Lovers data breach. That's a rich source of information, isn't it? Because you can now start mapping a whole bunch of behaviors of an individual. It's shady as hell, don't get me wrong. But you can see why that would be attractive. So it gets me wondering if maybe given these two different responses, if Apollo has been pulling some data from public sources, in which case they possibly didn't have a legitimate legal basis for processing it and they're deleting it, or they're just deleting it because they did have a legitimate legal basis, but they've been asked to delete it, so there is a right to erasure. And then for the other folks, it's like, well, look, we're just the data processor for someone else you gave the data to. Now, I don't want to go down the GDPR rabbit hole here, but I will actually share something else here, which is particularly fascinating and coincidentally came through at the same time. Someone sent me an email where they had sent a message to their local Belgian data protection authority, and they got a feedback. They got a bit of feedback from them. So that they basically contacted this authority and said, my data was in Apollo, I'm not happy. Effectively, we want you to take some action. Now, I've got a screen cap in here, which will inevitably go into this blog post. It's all in Dutch. And he gave me a translation of it. So I want to read you this translation. And this is how this Belgian DPA replied. It is not directly clear in which country Apollo is headquartered and if there is an office in Europe. In the latter case, then the privacy authority of that country is the lead in the story. In this case, it seems unlikely. Let me rephrase that. In this case, it seems like the company is based in the United States, San Francisco, that would limit a process from Europe severely. The purpose of a breach is, in the first place, you change your password so the company account can no longer be accessed with the old one. Now, I think this is really, really fascinating. And again, I don't want to go down the GDPR rabbit hole too much. But one of the things that I've always felt with GDPR is that it was almost like things were very, very quiet for a while. And then we started getting towards that deadline earlier this year and people started getting really, really excited and there was so much noise. And then it hit and everything went really, really quiet again, bar incidents like this where people pop up and say, well, GDPR will fix this. And I've always sort of maintained that until we actually have precedents, we're really not going to know how far GDPR gets pushed. And let's be clear, I want legislation that is aggressive, well beyond the scope of just Europe as well, that goes after organizations that stuff around with our data. Like we've got to have this, surely. It just seems like a basic human right. So I really want to see aggressive controls that allow us to do this. I have always been reticent to say that GDPR will do this to the extent that people think it will. I keep hearing from people, because I'm an EU subject, not necessarily resident or citizen. Apparently GDPR doesn't actually explicitly say that. It says data subject. Because I'm an EU data subject, when someone, let's say in the US, screws around with my data, I'll be able to go after them. And people have been very, very vigilantly expressing those messages. And in the Pluralsight course that John Elliott and I did around GDPR in practice, he sort of made the point that the practicality of a DPA, such as the Belgian one actually doing that, means that it's very unlikely to happen in all but a sort of a seriously egregious case. So in a case like this, where it's like, okay, we don't want people's data spread around, but it is names and email addresses, and it really wasn't much more than that. There was a bit of a... Well, actually, let me rephrase it. Apollo did actually have quite a bit of data, but it was data which was largely in the public domain and was just being misused in the way that myself and other people didn't expect it to be. The chances of a DPA going after some company in a foreign country outside the EU for something like that seems very, very low. And this actually seems to be what we're seeing now. And in fact, the guy who sent me the email, he made another comment. He said, so even under GDPR, companies like Apollo still have freedom to do whatever with our personal information as they please. And it's hard not to see where he's coming from. So I guess where I'm going with this is I would love to see more feedback about the experience people are having with Apollo, either responses from SARs. I know a bunch of people have mentioned the ICO, the Information Commissioner's Office in the UK. If you've had anything back from the ICO or any other regulator in the EU, I'd really love to see that feedback because I want to try and get something together that sort of says, now we have seen an incident, a bunch of EU data subjects' data has been exposed and has been misused in ways that they didn't expect. What actually happens under GDPR? At the moment, it's not looking like anything's going to happen. And I hope I'm wrong because I'd like to see the book thrown at organisations that misuse our data or don't protect it properly. But I don't know. So share anything that you have along those lines. I'll add to this. And then when I feel like I've got enough of a narrative around it, I'll publish it with all the information. And that's it, other than sponsor. So Tech Fabric, it is Tech Fabric this week. Tech Fabric has been sponsoring me this week, building reliable cloud-native applications that are also scalable as well, which is the joy of cloud these days. So big thanks to those guys for that. As I said earlier on, I'm going to be in this same chair for many weeks to come yet. So look, I hope this was interesting. I know there's a bunch of stuff. It was a little bit different to usual. But look, if you have comments or feedback, and particularly if you do have anything related to Apollo and GDPR, then please send that to me or leave a comment to that effect. So thank you very much for watching. I will come to you from the same chair next week.